a meeting of the Units of Measure Ontology Standards Working Group, sort of a subgroup of the Ontolog program. And the session chairs today are myself, Frank Olkin from National Science Foundation, and David Price from Eurostep. And our fourth panelist will be David Leal, who's going to speak on initial organization, some concepts defined within the VIM, the International Vocabulary of Metrology. Our second speaker will be Dr. James Masters, speaking on QDT, an OWL ontology for measurable units, for measurable quantities, units, and dimension systems, and dimensional data types. Our third speaker will be Gunter Schadow, who's going to speak on UCUM, Unified Code for Units of Measure. And our last speaker will be Edward Bachmeier, who's going to speak on a standard ontology for units of measure, current status as of September 24th, 2009. Each of these folks has slides, which you can reach on the teleconference webpage, which you can find at ontolog.zim3.net/cgi-in/wiki.pl?, and then conference call 2009-09-24, where conference call C, both C's are capitalized, and then underscores before 2009, before 09, and before 24. Or you can just search on Google for Ontolog and today's date and units of measure, or UOM. And I think I'll now, let's see, is there anything else? I think I'll hand it over to David Price to continue the panel discussion here. David?
Thank you. I guess what I'll add is that this is an activity that's been going on since the working group was initiated in June. There have been a very active email discussion and submission of various ontologies, models, and work efforts around the areas of quantities and units of measure. So there's several candidates just that need to be addressed and considered. There's also, at today's session, we're going to have two presentations on two new ones that have not been previously presented, the QUDT and UCOM. So that's very good in trying to move forward. And then after the several months of emails, we're trying to take an inventory and understand where we are and whether it's time to, if there's enough agreement, to take a first straw man look at an ontology supporting the units of measure and quantities defined in the VIM, the International Standard, International Vocabulary of Metrology. That's been the basis of much of the work and activities that have been going on. And then plan for an upcoming face-to-face meeting, which we'll talk about at the end of the at the end of the session, and see where we can get and how far along we can get, and then discuss issues like where should this go as far as standards making bodies, level of consensus, all sorts of things like that. So I apologize, I'm calling from home and have a 2-year-old in the house, so until I can unmute, we might have a little bit of an interruption here. So with that, I think the best thing for me to do is ask if there are any questions, and if not, we'll turn straight over to David Leal, who's going to talk about an initial organization of some of the concepts defined in the VIM. So any questions, David, or concerns at this point?
David, Peter asked us to mention today's date, which is September 24th, 2009. For those people who will be listening on by a record.
Absolutely. Very good. Thank you for that. And I will be monitoring the room, the Ontolog room, and if you have questions or concerns, push your the little hands up button, and then we'll at certain points in the program we'll call on you, and you can unmute yourself and make your comment, question, or whatever. So with that, I'll turn the discussion over to David Leal. David, can you unmute yourself?
Okay, yeah. Do you want to go to the next slide? I'm beyond the title. Well, the purpose of this was very informal, but I don't want too much to be read into this or any of the succeeding UML diagrams. The idea was to look at what was done in the VIM to produce essentially a diagrammatic representation of the different concepts which they defined, basically just grouping them. I've attached the definitions there on the figure, just as a scoping mechanism and as a sort of initial stab at what the sort of relations between the various objects are. And part of the reason for doing it is the VIM itself accepted that some of the terms they were defining had a number of different uses and set up essentially a table of possible meanings of the term in the VIM. And this diagram at least tries to tease that apart as a first stage for sort of setting out the concepts defined within the VIM. And so the most useful thing I think I can do is just briefly talk through what this diagram, what the boxes are meant to contain. Starting at the top, there was a concept of quantity, which had all the sort of engineering richness in it, so that, an example there is radius, given there for generic quantity, but you could have inside diameter and outside diameter and length and height and width, waterline length and the whole lot of engineering richness. And I think the understanding, certainly understanding what the intent of the VIM is, that these would all be within that box, whatever the name we would assign to that box. I think that's... Moving down to the left, we get kind of quantity. And again, kind of quantity is a term defined within the VIM. And there, given that, that in generic quantity we'd have radius and diameter and length and height and width, we would then move down to something, I'm saying, well, these are all lengths. And I think this goes along with the definition of mutually comparable. I could say that the width of this is greater than the length of that. So that was an initial looking at the kind of quantity. Moving to the middle, we have particular quantity, which is, again, the examples, again, was the radius of circle A, the waterline length of the Medway Queen, or whatever, particular examples of a property possessed by a body, or by a physical object, or a phenomenon, or whatever. And so that was the, I always think of these as buckets, and therefore that's named that bucket particular quantity. But all of those are essentially different meanings which VIM allowed for their term quantity, which they accepted as had possibly a number of different meanings. We then started with what was something which seems more straightforward, which is at the bottom, which is quantity value, and that seemed far less ambiguous, and essentially, as far as my understanding of what the VIM was saying, is that it's a data structure. It's a number combined with a reference, and one of the things which I noticed the VIM has is that the reference is not necessarily a unit, it's a reference, so it could be a reference to a unit, but it could be to a measurement procedure or a scale or whatever. And so there's the concept of quantity value, which seems relatively unproblematic, which is what it says it is. But then there is what has been added to this diagram, which is not in the BIM, which is this consequence, the box labeled magnitude of quantity. That is, quantity value is a data structure which is a description of something. There has to be the something which is described by this. And it is the something, the length, which could be described as 1 inch or 2.54 centimetres. And therefore, that object, I think, I had to produce a name for it and called it a magnitude of quantity. So this was an initial shot at, in some sense, essentially scoping and putting the various things of interest into different boxes and drawing some lines between them. The work which Ed produced then started saying, well, you know, some of these relationships are classification relationships and that sort of thing, but the objective of this diagram was just to put the things into boxes, as a put some names on the bit of paper and to outline the scope. Moving to the next slide. Next one. Some ways, as we get on to sort of more detailed stuff, it sort of gets somewhat simpler. The VIM defines concepts such as systems of quantities. A system of quantities, which is, and therefore, it obviously references particular kinds of quantity. Obviously, systems of quantities don't have the engineering richness of inside diameters and outside diameters in it. They just have lengths. So clearly, it's a reference to at least one of the meanings of kind of quantity. And then we can assign dimensions to kinds of quantities. This part of the model all seemed quite straightforward, and the terminology came reasonably straightforwardly out of the bin. It seemed non-problematic. Going on again, we get a similar, do you want to go to the next slide? And then there was a very similar structure associated with systems of units. Certainly it was of interest to me. Oh, I hadn't heard of the term system of quantities before looking at the VIM, but clearly for a system of units does imply a system of quantities for which one-to-one correspondence within the quantity and the unit within the system. And again, so the system of units is reasonably straightforward. What has been put in here, which is an ontological statement, which is this, whether or not a measurement unit is a subset of the magnitude of quantity, which is something which is being part of the discussion, and the discussion on the actual ontology which corresponds to these Strawman diagrams will work on that. And then the final one which I want to refer to, I think we can just move on to that, be past that one. And the final thing which we've been talking about really is the sort of scoping of our discussion, which has been going on, is the concept of scale. Again, it seems reasonable that a scale is something which is defined for a kind of quantity. We have a scale for length, we have a scale for mass and temperature, and that a scale has a space of values. Has been a discussion as to what is the nature of these values. I mean, whether or not they are numbers or whether they are quantity values as defined in the first overhead. But at least one of the interpretations of the scale is that it is this relationship between quantities or a particular kind and a particular space of values. So if I can summarize this, is that this initial set of UML diagrams, in terms of formality, the intent is not
too much to be read into them, but it's to gather together some examples and some terms as defined in the VIM and produce named boxes and at least hazarding some of the cardinalities of the relationships between them. So this was an attempt to sort of to kick off the discussion, and then the subsequent work on working out what ontology corresponds to this is what as follows, and I think other people are going to talk about that. So I would like to leave my part of this presentation there.
Okay, thank Hello? You, David.
I thought my phone had gone dead.
Oh, sorry. No, I just unmuted. Anyone have any? We have. That was a bit shorter than we had allowed in time for. So, are there any questions or issues at this point? Anyone would like to raise? Okay. Then our second speaker for today is Dr. James Masters, and could you introduce yourself as you come in and a very brief overview of what you're going to say before you dive into the presentation.
Okay. So, this is Pat Hayes. Am I on?
Welcome. Yes.
Sorry. I guess I have some questions. I apologize if these are a reflection of my not being completely up to date with the email discussions, but why is kind of quantity, since it sounds like a kind of quantity would be a classification of quantities, not related to particular quantity, but related instead to magnitudes of quantities? This is on page 2, the first slide.
Wait, Leo, are you still there? Can you unmute yourself?
Sorry, I responded to that with it still on mute. you're quite right. This was an initial take, and the synthesis which has gone on has said you definitely there's two understandings of kind of quantity. One as being something which is a type of particular quantity, and also also related to magnitude of quantity. So you're quite right. This is just something which should be in the diagram and isn't.
Okay, but I guess I don't understand why it's related to magnitude of quantity at all. So perhaps I'm misunderstanding what magnitude means.
Well, the thing, my understanding of what a magnitude of quantity is would be, for example, that length which is described by the quantity value 1.3 meters. It could also be described as by the quantity value of 50-odd inches. So
I
there
see.
Is a particular length. It's not associated. So there is a length. It's not a particular length of a particular object, but it is a magnitude of length which a number of particular objects could have. My table could have this length, and a child could have this height. So it's not
just clarify then. So just to clarify, a magnitude of something like 3.2 inches is a magnitude of quantity, not a quantity.
That's right. Well, there isn't a box called quantity, but it's saying though. I think that 3.2 inches was an instance of magnitude of quantity. Yes.
Yeah. Yes, I see. Yes. Okay, I guess then my head is so confused, I'm lost. So I'll take it offline. Sorry.
Okay. Jerry Raddick has his hand up. Jerry, could you unmute yourself and ask your question?
Yes, hi. I guess I have a similar question about this first chart here. The kind of stuff you're describing, like quantity values, what we call in some of our ISO SE4 standards property value. And I didn't think that was really...
ISO 4, it's representation.
Well, okay, in some of our standards, not in when in 10303, but we have this notion of a property value, which is, you know, property association between a property and a value, and it seems like that's what quantity value is, but I don't see why that's really within scope of this units of measure standards effort. I thought the units of measure standards effort was just going to concentrate on how do we describe units and magnitudes.
I think that's fair. On the other hand, you need a slightly bigger picture in order to focus in on the bits which you really, really think you really need. And it was a term which is defined in the VIN, therefore it belonged on the diagram.
If I could interject, David, I think the answer the answer to Jerry's question is simply that it's not possible to understand units of measure if you don't understand quantities. And the problem is that understanding quantities is not easy. And if you don't, then units of measure aren't going to mean anything.
Okay, but Ed, there's a lot of work being done in describing properties, and it seems to me like quantities, and there's not a clear distinction between quantities and properties. And so
actually, there is. That's just what David was saying, I think.
I believe what you call
a property is what he calls a generic quantity.
Yes, I think that's right. And because that's where all the richness is. The numbers of quantities, although there are quite a lot, they're in the hundreds, the number of properties in terms of things which would be measured aspects of an engineering part run to the millions, and they're all right at the top in terms of generic quantity. And I think that's a dreadful term. I think that top box should really be called property.
Nothing prevents you.
Actually, the definition, if you look up at the VIM, says a quantity is a property where the property has a magnitude.
Yes, it's quite right. But unfortunately, the definition for particular quantity says the same thing. Right, what he means is the difference is the one is in fact the abstraction. It's the property itself, the property independent of who has it, whereas the particular quantity is the property of a given thing.
Yeah.
Right, and the kind of quantity is a category of properties that are comparable, right?
Yeah.
That's the intent. That's the question I was going to ask, so now we're good.
Okay. The point is that you can make this comparable statement about the particular as well as
that a particular quantity has a generic quantity type, and the generic quantity has a unique kind of quantity, in effect that statement is derived.
That's fine. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Any other questions at this point? Jerry and Ed, can you lower your hand from the queue?
This is Frank Olson.
Just click on the hand again down at the bottom of the screen, the same button used to raise your hand.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions about David's presentation before we move on to the QUDT presentation? Okay.
Frank has a question.
Okay, Frank.
So I'm also confused as to why we have both quantity and particular quantity. They both seem to be a type of abstraction on particular quantity, and I don't quite understand the distinction being made here.
I'm afraid. Could somebody else with a better phone line who got that repeat the question?
My question is, I don't think I quite understand the distinction between generic quantity and kind of quantity. Unless generic quantity would be waist size and kind of quantity is length, and particular quantity is waist size of Frank Olkin.
That's right. That's exactly the intent.
Okay. You might want to elaborate the examples or something there. Okay, now I think I understand the difference. I guess I would call generic quantity here measure, or something. I understand the distinction you're trying to make.
So certainly it's a dreadful name. It's measure or property or something else, but not generic quantity.
Yeah. Generic sounds a little more generic than I think it is here. Okay.
Yeah, Peter Yim here. Maybe if I might interrupt some of the very pertinent issues, if people can document that on the chat board, I mean, that would be extremely helpful rather than just capturing it in the recording. If someone could just make a placeholder on the chat board, because the chat transcript becomes part of the session proceedings. Of course, the recording is, but you have to go through like a couple of hours of listening before you can come back to this. So please. Back to David.
Okay, any other... Frank, can you put your hand down if you're... that you're done. Any other questions? Okay, then we'll move on to Dr. James Masters, please.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. So, my name is Chip Masters. I usually go by Chip. My true name is James. So sometimes that causes some confusion. I am an ontologist at Top Quadrant, where I'm working with Ralph Hodgson, our CTO at Top Quadrant, and Paul Keller, who is the technical lead at NASA for the Constellation Data Architecture effort. And we have been working on our ontology of exactly in many of the same concepts that were just described in the previous presentation. So if you could advance to slide number 2, please. So I would like to just quickly go over what I intend to cover in this presentation. So after making some additional introductory remarks, I want to spend the bulk of my time reviewing and going back to many of the concepts we just discussed and describe how, give the definitions that we have been using for them, which will inform how to interpret the formal models that I'll show afterwards. So that would be the next part. And then I'll show, class diagrams and examples from the ontologies that illustrate how we're thinking about terms like quantity kinds and quantity and system of quantities. And then I would like to conclude by illustrating how we have applied what we've done so far to create functions that can do unit conversion and can do some dimensional analysis to compute the product or quotient of quantities, and then just talk about some of the continuing work that we're doing. Okay, so could you advance to slide number 3? So as I mentioned before, this work is part of an ongoing effort that is sponsored by NASA's Constellation Program to develop ontologies that will support their systems engineering lifecycle, in particular in specific areas such as telemetry and command and modeling and simulation. And I'm for those of you who have not heard of Constellation before, that is NASA's 30-plus year space exploration program to return to the moon and hopefully send humans to Mars. So a lot of the, and then the last thing I'll say here on this slide is that I was talking with Paul about, what's the executive overview of how he sees ontologies playing a role within the NASA Constellation Program, and it is to meet the short-term and long-term abilities, the non-functional requirements that are going to be in the end, the strategic points about that decide whether or not conservation programs succeed or fail, such as affordability, sustainability, operability. So, you know, could you take that to slide number 4? Okay, so just to, you know, go back to the conversation we were just having, I want to just say, you know, what we have been using as our definitions for these concepts, and some of these definitions are, you know, kind of fuzzy, and I can discuss them at more length, because I didn't have enough room to, you know, put the entire description in this presentation. So for us, a quantity kind is you know, really a type specifier for measurable properties of objects. So mass, velocity, power, torque. These are, for us, quantity kinds, whereas a quantity is a combination of a magnitude and a quantity kind. I think this is probably more closer to the notion of a generic quantity, as it was illustrated in the last presentation. So again, you know, for us, a quantity kind is a type that doesn't necessarily have, isn't associated with any particular measurement or any particular magnitude. It is the type that it corresponds to that magnitude or the thing being measured, the property being measured. So even though you might have situations where there may be two quantity kinds that are very similar, like length and radius, for example. My impression from the previous presentation is that length would be considered a kind of quantity and radius a generic quantity. Maybe that if I'm mistaken, hopefully someone can correct me after I finish. In our case, what we would do is recognize that length is a quantity kind. Radius is a more specific type of length. So we have a generalization. We have another hierarchy that links quantity kinds into a generalization hierarchy. And I can talk. That will become a little more clear when I show some examples. So could you continue to slide number 5, please? So, let me start at the last one here first, the quantity value. For what we call quantity value is an actual numerical expression of a quantity's magnitude with respect to a chosen unit of measure. So, 2 meters, 5 milligrams, 5 kilograms would be examples of particular values, whereas the quantity that would correspond to, so the length 2 meters as a quantity is a particular magnitude of length. It has a value in meters of 2. It would also have a value in feet of 2 times the conversion factor. And a unit of measure for us is simply a chosen scale where you have a defined way of specifying a unit of a certain quantity and then use that unit as a scale for measuring others of the same kind. And typically these things, units are named and they are, have very formal definitions and can be verified by experiment. Can you continue to slide number 6, I believe, now? And so we also have notions of systems of quantities and systems of units. In the most generic sense, we have a term, the term only applies to a collection of quantity kinds for a quantity system or a collection of units for a unit system. And From our model's point of view, that is all that is required is that a system is a collection of quantity kinds. A unit system is a collection of units. On top of that, we add structure to say that, well, if a unit system is associated with a quantity system, then every unit in the system must be a measurement scale, must be a unit corresponding to a particular quantity climbed in the quantity system. And again, I think this will look a little clearer when I show some examples. So if you can continue to the next slide, number 7. The last term is system dimension. And I called it system dimension because I wanted to make clear that a dimension is really only makes sense in the context of a chosen system of quantities, because you have to have a particular base set of quantities in order to define the dimension. But getting ahead of myself a little, you know, a dimension would correspond to, pardon me, let me back up. A derived unit, a derived quantity is a quantity that can be expressed as a product of base quantities, quantity kinds, raised to rational powers. In fact, in a particular quantity system, any quantity in the system can be expressed in terms of the base quantities. The vector or tuple of the exponent is the what we're calling the system dimension. So can you continue to slide number 8? I apologize for the resolution, but this is how the main class diagram. If you notice going down the center, you have a system of quantities. Every system of quantities is associated with one or more quantity kinds, which is in the middle. And then if you look at the bottom, a quantity has at most one quantity kind associated with it. So, again, at the bottom, you would have, for instance, a particular length, and it would have be of the kind length, and length would be a quantity in the SI system of quantities, for example. And if you look down the right-hand side, we have the corresponding system of units. There is a property that links quantity systems to unit systems. And then again, a unit system has essentially the same structure as a quantity system, with the additional aspect of differentiating between units that are coherent with respect to its base quantity kind, or ones that are not. And in the middle there, units also have conversion multipliers and conversion offsets, which are the just scalar numbers that we use for doing the conversions between units. And at the bottom right-hand corner, quantity value, that's the, these are the expressions of particular numerical values for quantities in a given unit or measure. So can you continue to slide number 9? This is just zooms in on the last point I was making. You can see it maybe a little more clearly. On the upper left, we have quantity kind. The generalization property there is a transitive property that we use to link quantity kind in a generalization hierarchy. So you would have length at the top, and then below that would put specializations like diameter or radius. And so let me see the other things to point out here quickly. The bottom right, a quantity value, now you can see that this is where you start to see associations with actual scalar values. So you have numeric value, which is holds the actual scalar value, and then we also have ways of stating the relative standard uncertainty and the standard uncertainty that would be associated with values when we're talking about a measured quantity where there is uncertainty in the measurement. Can you continue to slide number 10? So here's an example of a quantity on the, and you start from the left, we have a Planck constant, quantity Planck constant. It is a kind of action. It is a kind, quantity kind action. And in the middle there we have two expressions. We have one which is expresses the value of Planck constant in SI units, and the other which expresses the value in CGS units. And on the right hand, the far right, you see the terms corresponding to the actual units. So in the CGS system, the value of Planck constant is expressed in erg seconds, and in the SI system, it's expressed in joule seconds. So you can continue to slide number 11. So this shows the upper left side of my original main diagram, and it and what you see here is how we associate dimensions with quantity kinds inside of systems. So every system of quantities is going to have references to instances of a dimension, and every dimension has a corresponding reference quantity kind, which is to say that this is the dimension for this quantity kind in the given system. And bottom left, dimension vector is here just it's there for us to actually have a way of expressing the basis element in for a vector space where we can where a dimension actually then have a representation as a vector in a vector space, so we can do vector addition and subtraction to support the multiplication and division. So if you continue to slide number 12. So this illustrates how we model the permittivity as a quantity kind, and it's different dimensions in different systems of quantities. And this is a point that I was trying to make in our, perhaps not very effectively in our first call several months ago. And here the point is basically that you see permittivity will, have different dimensions in different systems. In the SI system, the expression is it's length minus 3, m minus 1, time to the fourth, current to the current squared. Whereas in the CGS system, when you define electrostatic units, permittivity becomes dimensionless quantity, or it's a quantity of dimension 1. In the CGS system, when you define electromagnetic units, the dimensions of permittivity are length to the minus 2 time squared. So if you continue to slide number 12. So I just want to now show some examples of using this ontology with some functions to create some functions. What we use to create the functions is the sparkle inference notation, which is an RDF vocabulary for defining constraint inference rules and functions using other RDF models. And so, as an example, I have this file on the web. There, I have a library of spin functions which utilize the QUDT ontology to convert between units to calculate product and quotient, and so on. So if you can continue to slide number 14, I will show you. Again, I apologize for the font. I have defined a function called convert, which will take three arguments, a double and a source unit and a target unit. So the idea is that the value in arg1 is an expression in the unit in arg2, and I'm going to convert that value to an expression in units of arg3. So if you look in the center of the page, this is the I have essentially a Sparkle query that uses the conversion multiplier, conversion offset properties of my unit class to do a calculation. And then under spend constraint, I have rules that will constrain the argument or well formed it. So if you continue to slide number 15, this just illustrates an example of how these functions are used. In the lower left, I am converting this quantity, which is actually the value for Planck constant in erg seconds. I want to convert it to electron volt seconds. And so spin allows you to do this calculation by calling the body of the function that I showed in the previous slide. And what you see in the top two panes are the forms that show the data that we have on erg second and electron volt second. And it's the conversion multiplier and conversion offset parts that are being used inside the function to do the calculation. One thing I would note, if you would go back one slide to number 14, briefly. If you see here under spin constraint, the first one, the filter is filtering when R2 and R3 are not comparable units. So what this is doing is, and we have a way of saying when two units are comparable, exactly when they are of the same kind, of the same quantity kind, or of quantity kinds that are specializations of the same quantity kind. So if arg1 was a unit of radius and arg2 a unit of length, then those would be comparable. So could you now continue to slide number 16? So here I have a function that will compute the product of two quantity kinds. So I could, for instance, take mass times acceleration and should get back as my answer force. The body of this function, again, is in the center, and it mainly is the main way this function works is by call, is by filtering on bound triples, but that's not off topic. And if anyone's interested in kind of more how the mechanics of how the defining these functions works, I'd be happy to talk about it offline. What you see in the center there is that the argument, the arg1 is a system of quantities, and the arg2 is and 3 are the quantity kinds I want to multiply. And then I can define constraints that require the kind in arg2 to be a member of the system in arg1, and similarly for arg3 and arg1. So again, the reason why this illustrates the fact that you have to have a reference to a system of quantities, because the way that this works is by doing basically doing vector addition or subtraction on the corresponding dimension vectors. So if you continue to slide number 17, I have an example of calling this function. So in the lower left, I am calculating the result of multiplying the quantity kind electric dipole moment by length, and the result is electric quadrupole moment. So what's going on behind the scenes is the electric dipole moment has a dimension vector, which is you can see in the upper left side of the resource form, and then on the right is electric quadrupole moment, and as you can see, they differ only in the length vector by one. So multiplying the left-hand side by length essentially is just increments the dimension vector for length by one, and it matches the dimension for a quadrupole moment. Okay, so could you continue to slide number 18? So that's from, you know, an overview of what we've done so far and what we have released on, you know, the QUDT website. Current and future work, I mentioned the title dimensional data type, and I didn't say anything about them. This is work that we need to move over into these ontologies. The idea here is that we, there's some talking in the background. I'm having a hard time hearing. So a dimensional data type system is an idea where you can, you know, put enough constraints on a quantity system or a unit system so that it's actually is a type system that you can use for specifying data types and doing compile time checks to verify that, like, that a variable, which is not only maybe a float, but it's a float that's a measure of length, is accurate. And if you do a Google search for dimensional, there is in Google Labs, there is a Haskell library of dimensional data types for quantities and units. And a lot of, you know, our interest is in having, you know, ontologies that can support those as well. We also, in addition, need to have models for equations that relate quantity kinds, or so that we can express not just physical laws like Coulomb's law or something, but also mainly engineering equations. And this really, you know, is starting to connect to how we're using this vocabulary with telemetry and simulation work with NASA. In addition, we want to, in a separate vocabulary, be able to distinguish the different, you know, types of mathematical objects that correspond to different quantity kinds. So something that is a torque should be represented as a pseudo vector. Something that's a measure of energy should be a scalar. And also to basically have the association between, you know, measurement events and the corresponding measured quantities, which will often be initially expressed in engineering units and then can be converted into other units. And finally, we need to, the ontology and how it discusses and models, quantities of dimension one is, needs improvement. There's a lot of things we need to distinguish, and I was hoping that may be an area where I can, you know, get some good advice and discussions with people in this community, because it is an area that I think there'd be a lot of discussion. Yeah. So I would invite discussion on that topic. And if you continue to slide number 19, please. Okay, so this is just wanted to give a list of the main sources that we used to find the consensus definitions of terminology, to find data that we were using. I took the definitions of electrostatic and electromagnetic units from Jackson, and then that seems to jive with everything I found online as well. So last slide, number 20, please. I just wanted to provide a link to where, you know, these ontologies are available in both OWL, in both RDF XML and N3 at this website. That includes the main schemas and instance data for what I show today. Plus, we have additional graphs that have the physical constants published in the NIST website converted into our ontology, and we also have another graph that provides links between the concepts in our ontology and DBpedia. So that is the end of my presentation. I hope that I was understandable in my speech. Thank you.
Okay, so Ravi Sharma, please go ahead.
Yes, a quick question is, there are actually two related ones. Have you applied these set of vocabularies and terms in a practical situation to do something to a real mission, to validate, to IVNV or something like that? Or are we still in the formation stage? And second question is, when you particularly apply it to constellation, you have to set the context right, otherwise the same unambiguous meaning of terms may even be difficult, even though you develop a vocabulary for it.
Could you I'll answer the first question and then ask you to repeat your second question. The ontologies are being used in application development that's ongoing at Ames Research Center here, and I am not sure if it is being used in operational software yet, but we are certainly using it to develop the applications that are supporting the data architecture registries here. And I've been receiving emails from people. I believe others are finding uses for it in e-commerce applications, and it's also been added to the Linked Data Cloud, but I honestly don't have a lot of statistics on how it is currently being used, but it is being used in development, not just in research. And so, to ask you to repeat your second question.
Well, second question is an unambiguous way of developing vocabularies that don't cut across complex disciplines like human spaceflight. A lot of terms for life support systems, for human systems, versus, let's say, an autonomous Mars mission with unmanned satellites. So the context setting would be quite complex for Constellation program as compared to, say, Voyager, Mariner, or one of these Cassini or other missions for unmanned planetary probes.
Okay, I still can't find a question in that.
If I were to develop a vocabulary for Cassini, which is going around the Saturn, versus on Constellation, I just cannot help but have repeated vocabulary terms in such a complex situation, which may mean two different things. So how would you isolate it, one from the other? Other than from lengthy context setting. Otherwise, we'll take it offline.
But maybe better. I'm not quite understanding whether your question is about Constellation or.
It's a lot more complex situation in Constellation, so I was looking for you to say, okay, when we develop some vector for reaching orbital level, we use this vocabulary set or that one.
Oh, I see. Well, I mean, I honestly can't, address some of that because I'm not, really the expert in that. I mean, what I can say, I think maybe you might address something about this, is that, while this is a an effort that's funded under and, developed under the Constellation program, the desire is, I think, you know, to see not just to see these ontologies and other ontologies being developed at other NASA facilities and by other NASA organizations to eventually form overall umbrella, which will help remove the potential for ambiguity of terminology across all systems. But I would refer you to Paul Keller if you have specific questions about the application of this and within NASA.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
Anyway, this is Gunta. I'm back.
Ed Barkmeyer, could you unmute yourself and ask your question, please?
Thanks. Yeah, I'll try to make this quick. We'd really like to get on with the rest, I think. The question, Chip, is on slides 8 and 9, when you're doing quantity values, you have references to so-called standard uncertainty. I had no idea what that meant until I saw the reference to the NIST reference on constants at the back. So now I'm sort of guessing. When you refer to standard uncertainty, you mean, for example, with reference to the base unit itself? Or that was the question. I mean, what is the notion standard uncertainty?
Here I'm going to expose my ignorance to a lot of this and say that what I did, I added those, standard uncertainty and relative standard uncertainty based on what I, my reading the NIST website. And
okay, that's all I needed to know. That was the question. Is that the definition?
Yeah. That's exactly it. I my background's in mathematics. I know some, I know something about sampling and statistics, but I'm not going to pretend to be an expert in this area.
Well, as it turns out, you have two people on this call. One of them is I'm NIST, but I'm like you. But there is a guy on this call who is out of the part of the world that does exactly that kind of stuff. Okay, so this is probably useful. So this is based on that notion is based on the NIST specification on the NIST document, and that's good. Then I know what the definition is. Thank you.
Okay.
Ed, you can poke the little button and lower your head. Anyone else have questions at this point in time? I see Frank Olken. Can you unmute yourself and go?
One of my questions is vector magnitude was given as a float. I've never seen an example where it was anything other than an integer. This isn't a dimension in the representation of a dimension as a vector of basis dimensions.
If you look at the dimensions for electric current in CGS, when you define electrostatic units, you have fractional, exponents. So, you can define, because, I think in the case of Coulomb's law, I believe, you can relate force to length. You can relate electric current to force and then, do the algebra to solve for electric current, and the dimensions turn out to be, square root of force, I believe. So there are cases where you do have fractional dimensions.
But force is not usually a basis.
Right, but then you write force in terms of basis units, and then now you take the square root of that, and you get fractional powers.
Okay, I'll look. You said
I can continue.
I'll contact you.
Okay.
Okay. No one else has their hand up, so I'll ask: Are there any other questions at this point in time? okay. If not, then hopefully I see from the chat that Dr. Gutter-Shado has had some issues with the phone. So could you unmute yourself and
yes.
have a presentation on unified code for units of measure?
Hello? Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Yes.
Very well. So yeah, I do have to apologize. My name is Gutter-Shado, and you may all want to go to the presentation first slide. I'm sitting here on the floor in a hotel where there's a meeting ongoing, so it's not a good position to hold a talk. And I hope that you will get the voice and that you won't be interrupted. By way of introduction, may I want to make this quick. I've been with the medical informatics standards community for about 15 years, and as you can imagine, in medicine, we do a lot of measurements, both in chemistry, physiologic measurements, basically everything is in scope. And so I developed this standard, this specification, Unified Codes for Unit of Measure, and I'm going to talk with you about, I guess this is enough for introduction. You may skip over the abstract that's just there to have an abstract. So we are on slide number 3. I want to just give the scope and purpose where all this comes from. Notice the name is called Unified Codes for Unit of Measure. What the purpose of this is to facilitate communication of measurements from computer to computer, so from one database to another, from a laboratory to a patient record is one example of many others. As the focus is on communication from computer to computer. So what we're creating is a code system, which is a set of symbols encoded in some ASCII characters so that you can easily send those around. And these code systems existed before we started. There was a standard called ISO 2955, and I think it was last updated in 1983, and another U.S. standard, ANSI X350, which added to the international SI unit some of those customary units, you know, such as pounds and mile and stuff like that. And in my standard organization called HL7, House Level 7, which I'm a member of, they have taken these and have added yet other units that are required for medicine. For example, I think millimeter Hg, millimeter mercury column was not included in any of these other standards, so they added it. And a number more. Some of our people in our standards group are dealing with radiology and radiotherapy, so they have units like that are known out of high energy physics and so forth. So we have a pretty wide scope that went beyond the scope of the outstanding ISO and ANSI standards in that field. I want to make the distinction when we talk about ISO standards. There is, of course, you know, ISO, what is it, 80,000 or the TC12 in ISO that creates the metrology standards and that watches over, you know, the SI system, and then I guess DIPM is also there. We're not, this UCOM stuff is not competing at all with what those people are doing. All we're trying to do is take the concepts that are defined in those committees and commonly used in physics and apply and make them communicable from one computer to another. In order to do that, one of the first experiences that we have with these existing standards like ISO 2955, which no longer is actually in existence, but anyway, issues that we found with those were that they didn't actually define any of the meaning of the units that they were communicating, and they not only that, but they also contained ambiguities. So you could construct expressions which were not precisely clear as what they would mean. it got even worse with this ANSI standard that added these U.S. customary units, because there's a huge amount of ambiguity when it comes to customary units, just what a pound is. And, you know, there are three different systems of pounds, the Abertupois system, the Troy system, and the Apothecary system, and they are considerably different. But without knowing which system you're talking, then all you're doing is exchange words, but you don't understand what the meaning of those words is. So what we've been trying to do while fixing the ambiguities of the code was also to establish the meaning. And this is the main point that I was going to talk about. So I'm going to skip over slide number 4 and 5 very quickly. Just the point that we're focusing a lot on these codes that people can write down that can be put into computer messages and communicated from one computer to another. But we understand, of course, sometimes people look at those codes and try to understand them. So our unit codes are pretty much what you would expect when you were to communicate physical measurements in an email, for example, with a restricted character set. What you would type there is, you know, in 80% of the cases, valid UCOM code. As long as you understand the SI system and how you create metric units and how you should write that. So you're not supposed to write cc for cubic centimeter, which a lot of my medical colleagues are doing, that you write cm3 for centimeter to the power of 3. But we want to talk about semantics. What I'm inviting you to do is, you know, either now or later on, follow along, go to the UCOM website, which is http://unitofmeasure.org, and there's a bunch of text there, and you can browse through that, but there's also shortcuts to the specification. So what I'm doing is I'm just going over the specification a little bit, focusing on the semantics. We're going to slide number 6 now. So the slide number 6 shows the table of contents, which is, introduction, we're past that. There is a grammar of units and unit terms that's about syntax of how to create expressions in this unit code system, in this unit language. And we are not going to talk about that much at all because I'm assuming that most of you are from the field of physics and you know exactly how this is done. And really, all we're trying to do here is, in a formal syntax, in a formal grammar, define pretty much what the expectations are that you all would have against, writing unit expressions. So we're focusing on semantics. And the point of our specification is that we use terminal symbols that we define that have semantics that you can combine to create expressions of units, such as you will see in a moment. So here's an example of the syntax. We define units. I'm sorry, I'm going to slide number 7 now. So we define units, atoms as we call them, also terminal symbols, such as G for gram, M for meter, also MIN for minute, and then those other units that are not in the SI system, but nevertheless required in the real world that we're in. For example, what you see there is international inch, and then also the meter of mercury column as a unit of pressure. So then we allow the prefix combination kg for kilogram and so forth, just the stuff that you know. We're preventing using prefixes with non-metric units, so you can't write milli-inch. That's not possible. You can't write milli-minute. That's not possible. But you can write millisecond. And then, of course, you create the terms, but in scope of the unit terms is exponent, so you can write meter to the square, centimeter to the third power, multiplication, kilogram times meter, division, meter per second. With examples, you can combine all of the above, kilogram times meter per square second, and you can also add numeric factors, such as milligram over 12 hours, which is unfortunately what people in medicine sometimes want. We also have annotations, which have no semantic value at all. You can write kilogram potatoes or milligram creatinine in these curly braces. which is something, again, that people are trying to do because they think that's important when, in fact, when you just look at the meaning of units, it's not really important that you write that you're measuring potatoes. That information should be somewhere else, the map of the potato. But people nevertheless want to write it, so we allow it with these curly braces. Now we go to the semantics. So slide number 8. First of all, the intuition about the semantics, I think you're all very well aware of that. When we write a unit such as 1 newton, then it is defined precisely as 1 kilogram times meter over square seconds. And when we all understand that the SI system has base units, and we can write every of these unit expressions as a term of where you multiply the base unit, and each base unit is in a different power. So you can take the base unit and just take the exponents and take these numbers that are the exponents of the base unit to put them in a fixed vector, have an additional factor in front, then you can represent pretty much all the units that are in a normal standard metric unit system. So intuitively, every unit is represented by a factor and a vector of exponents over the base unit. Okay? So here's some examples. So for the newton, 1 kilogram meter per square second, it's 10 to the power of 3 as the factor, and then the unit exponent vector is 1 minus 2, 1, and the rest is 0. So we're moving to slide number 10. This is my attempt to define the semantics of the units of measure in the UCOM system, and the approach that we're choosing here is just to try to make a little algebra that says here what are the terms, what are the equivalence relation that you have in the set of units that you can write using these terms, and what is what are the rules for the algebra here, and that's pretty much it. So we think we can define the semantics of the units, and only the units. We're not talking about quantities or, there's other standards for those. So for the units, we think we can define the semantics in a relatively efficiently. So we're going to slide number 11, where we can start that to say in our set of unit expressions, we define two binary symmetric reflexive and transitive relations, which are equivalence relations, of course. What are we call equals? So that means one unit equal another unit. And another one we call is commensurable with. So that's the unit, the two units in that have a common dimensionality. So you can convert a value of writing with one unit, you can convert it into the other unit. Moving on to the next slide, number 12. Then we define the algebra of units. So there's equivalence classes generated by the equality relations. Those equivalence classes we call units. So one centimeter, 100 centimeter is one unit, and 1 meter is another unit, and they are equal. They're exactly equal. There's no difference between them. The set of units has a binary multiplication operator, so we're just going over these simple operators, multiplication, division, then exponentiation. And this is all pretty much what you would expect. I'm not really a mathematician, so for you mathematicians, it should be totally trivial to define an algebra like this. We also have a product, of course, of the unit with the rational, with a real number, scalar, so to create another unit. So that's a scalar unit. So we can move on to the slide number 13, paragraph 19, dimension and magnitude. The equivalence classes generated by the commensurability relation are called dimensions, and we have some axioms about that. In slide number 14, so far we haven't discussed base units and derived units yet. We just talk about units in general, and all of these axioms we have so far would hold for all units in general. And we are relatively agnostic about what base units and what derived units are, because we realize that the system has changed, the system of base units, and it's going to change even as we speak. For example, that the SI unit system has 7 base units, and currently Candela is one of the base units. But that is been a long-standing problem. I think some of you on the list have also argued, and I have myself argued that for quite some time, that the Candela having in there is an oddball. There's a new project in the ISO CC12 deal with these psychophysical physiologic units in a more rational fashion. So we might see the base unit to actually change. So the UCOM is relatively agnostic about the base units. You can take any system of units that you define as the base, and you can make the UCOM the unit expression and the semantics hold exactly the same way, regardless of what your base units are. Slide number 15 just shows you the base units, and I'm seeing a question here. What's commensurable? Is it defined anywhere? That simply means that you have two expressions of a quantity that are comparable. So you can say one is bigger than the other, or one is less than the other. Maybe we hold for the questions until in a moment. If the chair wants to give me a warning that I'm expiring my time, please go ahead and just chime in verbally. Okay, so slide number 15 is just a list of the base units, and you see, of course, it creates the base vector of our unit space, so it's pretty trivial at this. Slide number 16 just shows you some examples of how the semantics with this factor and the vector of the exponent works. Slide number 17 is just sketching a little bit the surface of some of the problems that we have. I think we have solved this one in particular. If you take a common unit such as degrees Celsius and you compare that with Kelvin, then you know that there is an offset as well as a scale factor in place for some unit conversions. And what we have come up with is a way of defining special units which have some special properties which allow you to make more general scale transformations using a pair of functions that we use to convert from and to these the other special units. So every special unit is defined based on a regular or proper unit, and then a pair of functions that convert from and to that other unit. And for example, for these special units, you can move to slide number 18. They use degrees Celsius, degrees Fahrenheit, but also the pH as a kind of a special thing, which is based on the concentration of protons. And then you have also the logarithmic units are handled as these special units. So I want to kind of wind down my talk here. On slide number 19, I find of note when I compare what we're doing with UCOM and describing the semantics of units is that we define the semantics algebraically, which is quite different from what I see people doing with UML and OWL and methods like this. I find that we can have only a very small handful of axioms in this algebraic schema, and we can not only understand pretty much all that's going on with units, but you can also make a straightforward implementation, very efficient implementation at that. We've done this several times. I have to apologize for the background noise. I hope I can still be heard. Our implementations of units that I've done several times and other people too allows you to do constant-time reasoning because of the simplicity of the vector and the factor and potentially the function. Nevertheless, we've done some experiments with writing UML models or other schematics to understand what's going on here, especially how to implement in computer programs the UCOM system. So the picture you see on slide number 20 shows you one UML diagram that kind of tries to describe how I have implemented at least once the UCOM approach. And then there's this, you know, slide number 21, a somewhat elaborated UML diagram that touches a little bit on issues like quantity and magnitude, which are actually sort of out of the scope of the unit system, of the UCOM system, but nevertheless we're touching it. So we try to describe it in that UML model. Slide number 22 is another UML model. They all have somewhat of similarity, but this one is one that appeared in the ISO draft 11240 from the Health and Biomedical ISO Committee TC215. So the point of these UML models is not so much that I'm advocating for any of them, but more that I find it always stunning that I have so much difficulty to come out with the UML model of this, but I seem to have no difficulty to understand how the units work using this algebraic semantic definition. Maybe one limitation to point out is I see you guys are discussing a lot about what's mass and what's quantity and magnitude and all of that. UCOM is pretty much agnostic to that because all we want to do is communicate units with a precise semantics, and that's what we do best. Current status of UCOM is that it's been moving from just a rote public specification into something that's been adopted by large standard organizations in the field of biomedical as well as geographic information systems and some, you know, energy resource exploration. People have been using the UCOM as well as diagnostic imaging. People, some of them are physicists. We've seen a pretty nice adoption over the last few years of this. So what we're working on now a little bit is to try to formalize more of the organization and government aspects of the standard as it moves to be adopted into some ISO standards. We have very few requests for new entries to this terminology. That's interesting. It contrasts a lot with many other terminologies, especially in our biomedical field, that have a huge turnover of new concepts coming through. We don't have much. We have maybe 3 or 4 requests a year that we have to deal with. The one exception of that is that there is a huge amount of procedure defined or arbitrary units that people are used in biomedical field, which we have trouble. We don't like them. They're not real physical units in the original UCOM point of view. There's no place for them in the SI system. And nevertheless, we have to deal with them because we decide to cater the biomedical field. And this is a work item that's currently still ongoing. And currently, we only have an imperfect solution to just deal with the problem for the time being, but it's not finally resolved. Translation, internationalization, that's not so important. Well, I think that's close to my last slide, number 25, and I thank you for your attention, and I'm ready for any questions you have.
Ravi Sharma is first in the queue for questions. So, Ravi?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Dr. Shadow, who are the main users of the, or likely main users of the UCOM? And I have other questions later.
So the users are... Currently, UCOM is adopted in healthcare interoperability standards in the United States. There are several national interoperability initiatives that communicate patient laboratory results and patient medical records, drug knowledge, and they have been they're using UCOM. Internationally as well. You're having another question?
No, that's fine. I got the idea.
Okay.
The related units that are used, let's say, in a radiological investigation or imaging radiological application would be a set of what we would probably like to call tuples, right? Related measurements that form a set for a given application or purpose. So is that a way to understand the semantic algebraic concept that you were trying to communicate, or is it something more?
Actually, less. when you mentioned tuples, maybe you're referring to an expression of complex measurements, such as you can take, for example, an EKG waveform.
Yes.
You know, where you have multiple measurement samples from and they're all the unit is millivolt for all of them. So this sort of thing we do that in our standards organization in related standards organization from the field of radiology and also devices, medical devices, to define what are the structures in which to communicate these complex measurements.
Yes.
Units, the UCOM, is much simpler. All we do is tell you how you communicate millivolt and what it means in relationship to volt.
So I would understand an EKG to mean show me on 1 centimeter scale the magnitude and then the T wave reversal, and is it a 3-lead or a 9-lead measurement, etc. So this would define one measurement of EKG.
That's something that's in the scope of the health standards organizations that I am in, but it's not in the scope of UCOM. UCOM only tells you about millivolts. That's all it does.
Millivolts.
Not about 9 leads, and not about, you know, it doesn't define the properties that you're measuring. It just defines the units.
I see. But there is only one electrical measurement in a EKG. So that's in millivolts. That's fine. I understand it now. So what are the relationships between different algebraic terms that you showed in those expressions?
The relationship between the terms?
Yes.
So basically, units are a set of concepts, and they are defined with equivalence operations, as well as multiplication, division, exponentiation. So now what you can do, because of the equivalence relation, that implies that you can have conversion, right? That you can say 100 centimeter is equal to 1 meter, and all the other conversions. And you can also do any other mathematics with it. Like you can say, you can take meter of height and now what is it? Mass of the body that you elevated to that height and the acceleration of the earth, and you can say, well, that kinetic energy, a potential energy that this body now has is, you know, you can just simply multiply and divide the way you have, we all learned it in physics, right? And you can do that with dimension expression with a number and a unit. And you just compute with them, and your result is going to be in the right, in the right dimension, the right unit. So what you can do with UCOM, as if you implement it, is you can do conversion and computation. Pretty straightforward.
Oh, okay. Thank you. That is useful.
Pat Hayes is next in the queue with a question. Pat?
Yeah. I guess a question and an observation. One example we discussed earlier in the email was Rockwell hardness, which is a hardness scale, right, which is not, doesn't form a real field or a group or any of these analogous mathematical quantities. Nevertheless, it's widely used in engineering circles and of great practical utility. How would something like that fit into your framework, or would it just not fit?
Okay, here's how it fits in it. So it's somewhat of a trivial way, so that it isn't really going to do much.
the hardness scale is really just an ordinal scale.
Yeah.
Right? So as such, it is not even a physical quantity that requires any unit. Therefore, UCOM really isn't going to do anything there.
Yeah, okay.
But I will give you a little bit of background because of these other standard organizations that I'm in that define properties that you measure. So you might define a property or quantity or kind of quantity, that says this is the what you call it, Rockwell hardness, right? And then you say, well, what's the kind of quantity? Well, the scale is ordinal. So you know there's never going to be a unit. And you express your value using integer numbers or ABC, I don't know what exactly, probably integer numbers or maybe even Roman numerals, whatever, it doesn't matter. It may be fine that there is an ordering, a total order in the set of values, but it doesn't have units, so UCOM doesn't really apply.
It doesn't have physical units, right. Okay. So let me just make the quick observation, which is that your later slides where you contrast the algebraic formulation with more symbolic methods. I mean, I think you, I know what you're saying, and what you say is perfectly correct, but I think there are symbolic methods, symbolic techniques, in particular the use of an explicit logic, which encompass both, you know, which in which the algebraic forms can be used directly and equational reasoning can be used efficiently. So I just wanted to put a little note there about, one shouldn't make that contrast too, dramatic.
Point noted.
Okay.
Ed Barkmeyer is next in the queue with a question.
Yes, Gunther, thank you very much for this presentation. This actually distills a lot out of what I hadn't understood before about UCUM. The one thing that I was going to ask is, in Chip Master's presentation, he observed, for example, that the relationship between a dimension space, a dimension expressed algebraically, and the relationship between quantity kinds and dimension spaces is many to one. That is, there are a number of quantity kinds that are distinct kinds of quantities and therefore incomparable that have the same apparent dimension spaces. They would look like the same units, or more accurately, they look like the same algebraic combination of units. The notable kinds of things that people distinguish, for example, are as between torque and energy is a perfect example. And yes, there's whole issues about representing torque as a vector. But the there are others of that form where you simply have units that look comparable, but the quantities themselves aren't comparable because they're measuring entirely different kinds of things. And that's because, among other things, of the dimensionless unit problem. So, if I understand you correctly, the semantics of a unit is its dimension, is its dimensional equivalence. The model in UCUM doesn't actually distinguish kind of quantity. It assumes comparability if in fact the base unit equation is the same.
Yeah. That's exactly right, and this is on purpose, not out of ignorance.
Yeah, I figured it was not out of ignorance.
Right. So now, let me elaborate a little bit. I know what you mean when you say the dimensionless units problem, but I think this is only a special case. You can have an expression as simple as 1 meter, and another expression as 1 meter that is where you might say these are not really comparable. Because one is the height of my little daughter, and the other is the wavelength of the shortwave receiver that I'm tuned into. Okay? So these are not comparable, but yet we write 1 meter. Now, does that mean that 1 meter is not equal to 1 meter? No, it doesn't mean that. So here's where it stops being trivial. I think what we need to make sure is that you distinguish between units and quantity. So when you express a quantity, you need to say what is the kind of quantity that you measure. In ISO lingo, in ISO circles of people that go to BIM or so, some of them call it kind of quantity or kind of property, and they make different, abstractions
right.
of those. But it's important to realize that the unit does not include the property that you're measuring. And so whether or not you can say that you can compare the height of my daughter with the wavelength is actually depending on what you really want. Because sometimes it might actually be comparable. Because if you make an apparatus in which you can visualize the wavelength and you can put my daughter next to it, and you can actually start comparing the two, but it all depends on what you want. So it's important to realize that the units will never be able to encapsulate the meaning of what you have measured. And when we say two dimension quantities are comparable, all we're saying is that the units are, that they are in the same dimensionality, not that they are in the same kind of quantity.
Yes, I want to be very careful. From the SI point of view, the height of your daughter and the wavelength of some particular color are actually comparable. But the problem is that things that involve multiplication by otherwise dimensionless units are the problem. Now you actually have obviously another quantity in the dimensional equation, but it doesn't show up as a quantity in the unit equation. That's the concern I had. And we can argue obviously about the comparability of properties like the heights of people versus wavelengths, but as I said, in the SI convention, those two are comparable. The particular problem, however, is that there are cases where you are clearly talking about, if you look at the expression of the quantity kind as a, if you like, a similar structure of multiplications of other quantity kinds, at the level at which they are considered, you may find that some cancel each other out, but they have a great, but they are different units. And as a consequence, the units may appear to be the same, but the quantities are, in fact, entirely different things. And I don't know how to get around that. I mean, this is one of the issues we've gotten around. You can obviously create the algebra. The problem is that when you try to reduce the semantics of a derived unit to the algebra, you get into these issues about quantity kind. And I noticed that the QUDT ontology makes very clear in its comparison function, the first question is, are these things of comparable quantity kinds? Then I can look at how to convert the units. And that was the distinction between that model and the UCUM as I saw it. And I just wanted to be sure that where you are, I understand why you said what you said, which is just what you said. When you disagree about properties, you may actually be comparing things that ISO would have said are comparable, but the people involved don't think are comparable, which is a different matter. Because ISO, as you say, isn't measuring what property you're talking about.
Yeah, I think in general, I think I seem to be agreeing exactly with the previous speaker, because so UCOM is no different there. If you want to compare two quantities, and they're two expressions of quantities, I should say, not the real world quantity, but what you write down as these quantities,
right?
And I'm disregarding the kind of property that was measured. Then I can make senseless comparisons.
Right.
And the point with UCOM is we're not refusing that or in any way. All we're saying is that our scope really is only the unit and not the properties. We know that the property specification is also required, and if you want to compare to quantity expressions, you need to consider the property first, whether those are comparable, and then the units are relatively easy, in comparison with the properties.
Thank you.
Peter, you're in the queue now. I gather we need to move on to the next presentation.
Can you hear?
Peter?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, now we can.
Okay. I guess we might as well go on to the next presentation. I just typed out my issue, and I guess we can address it when we go to open discussion, which probably is more appropriate then. And Gunther has a little bit of time to think it over as well.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Peter. Then the next presentation. presentation will be Ed Parkmeyer on the process we're going through making a standard ontology for unit and measure and the status of our current activities. So, Ed, over to you, please.
Thanks. I think I'm on. Yeah. Yeah. Peter actually put me up to this. This is sort of, as Dave said, this activity originated out of a decision of the Ontolog Summit that was, what, last February, or no, must have been April. And the result really was that, I guess it was the end of April, so sometime in May or June, we finally started getting together what we might actually do. And I can go on to slide two here. What we identified in an email that I would describe as nobody disagreed with was five tasks that need to be done along the way to making a standard ontology. And they are listed here as requirements gathering, language selection, literature search, initial draft, and obviously subsequent drafts, but certainly an initial draft, and the creation of a standards development organization project, a project in an SDO. So all I'm really doing is reporting against where we are at this moment, and I apologize that these slides went on the server this morning at something like noon, which isn't this morning. And this is, as I understand the current state to be, others may disagree. The first observation is that with respect to requirements gathering, we've had actually these two web conferences. We've had some seven presentations and a lot of emails. But nobody, and unfortunately I volunteered to do this and didn't do it, nobody's actually written it down yet, what we've actually gotten thus far. And I'm reasonably sure, after some discussions of some of the emails, that there are a number of issues that are going to show up or that have been sort of hinted at rather than described in detail that are going to be issues when we actually come to what the ontology is going to cover. Günter, for example, just raised what I think is a very important question. Jerry raised the same question earlier. What's actually the scope of this ontology? If you constrain it to units and stay away from certain aspects of quantity, it makes life a lot simpler or a lot more complicated. So we're going to have issues like that that we really haven't discussed yet, and it makes it very hard to decide what we ought to be doing. And I think probably we need to do a little bit more organization in that vein. The noted responsible party at the bottom, I almost wrote irresponsible party. I've had other activities, and like our worthy chair, I haven't gotten much done in this process. But certainly there has been an amount of material that's gone out, and I need to organize that in some ways and put it in as a draft that we can start talking about and expanding on to get a pretty clear indication of what we need to do in the OM ontology and to get agreement on what we need to do, what the scope is. The second problem was actually easier to do. Language selection, what happened was that we ended up having to choose an ontology language. There really are only a handful of standards. I think actually Chip alluded to another one that I hadn't thought about, which is, because I'd always thought of the OWL full as OWL plus some RDF expressions that you couldn't put into OWL. But Chip is right that actually SPIN gives you another alternative as a means, and we haven't actually talked about that. But we haven't gotten beyond the OWL V2 stage. We are still in the, what are the classes and properties level. Once we start into the question of how we write axioms, how we write class definitions, how we write property definitions, it will become apparent what things we actually need in terms of an expression language to complete the reasoning capabilities for the ontology. OWL will give you certain things. The intent of some of us is that we need a parallel axiomatic formulation, and the ISO standard for that at the moment is CLIF, and it has various grammars, but the bottom line is that the underlying model is one model, and there are a number of, and CLIF is a representation, there are other representations. For those of you who aren't familiar, CLIF is ISO 24707, and it's sort of the modern generation of CIF, although there is a modern generation of KISS that is slightly different. The other thing we had been talking about before, which I think David's slides and I notice many other people's slides have come to, is that we're all starting to use UML to draw the pictures. Okay? And I think that's a good thing, and we sort of agreed that that's what we're going to do. How we actually map the UML pictures into the formal OWL has this little note that says that there's an OMG standard that was constructed for exactly that purpose for OWL V1. It is a so-called UML profile for OWL, and it uses certain standard UML markup features to describe exactly what you meant in OWL. And we may well find it useful as we get closer to finalization of our ontology to use that as a way to present the ontology. Literature search, yeah. And one thing I'm pleased to see is that pretty much everybody who has been involved now agrees that the standard reference, the basic standard reference for understanding quantities and units of measure is in fact the VIM, the International Vocabulary for Measurements. I've seen that now in, I think, 6 presentations, so that's probably a pretty good indication of consensus. There are a number of existing ontologies. We had people who were going to go visit these existing ontologies and in theory tell us what's in them with respect to units of measure so that we can look at alignment and parallels. One of those is in fact QUDT. Thank you, Chip. We now actually have a presentation on that one. There are some others that we have that are out there in the literature that presumably there are experts on or people familiar with. It would be nice actually to get somebody to offer a quick overview. And what we really need to do with that, which is, sorry, go on to slide 6, is the analysis and comparison part. I mentioned I've got this other list that says there really are some other formal models that aren't ontologies per se, or I guess we could argue about whether they are some weak form of ontology, that are in proposed standards, and UCUM is one of those. We heard from the units of L people the last time out, and there's one other that was, I would describe it, brought to the attention of several of us about 2 weeks ago, which comes from NASA JPL instead of NASA Ames, and it's called QUDV. I wonder to what extent the individuals actually spoke to each other, but nonetheless, it's a UML model, and it is intended at the moment as an annex to another standard. In any case, obviously we need to look at all of these things and ask ourselves the bullet that's middle way down the slide here. How do they relate to one another? What issues do they raise? What issues does one solve that another one doesn't? And so on. And we haven't done anything in that vein yet. And we haven't identified people who are going to do it. So this is kind of where we are at the moment. We've said we need to do this, and I think it's pretty clear that we do, because this is our starting point. And the question is, where does this come from? Who's going to do it? This is the who's going to tie the bell on the cat's neck. And, you know, everybody's got day jobs, but we actually, if we're going to do this, need to commit to doing this and decide how. I have to say, by the way, that this approach to things I have borrowed from Mark Linehan's work for Date and Time, because they had the same problem. There were a dozen outstanding documents, and we had to pull them all together and look and see what was actually there and what we could use to proceed. The remaining situation is where we are in specification, slide 7. Dave Leold put the draft that you've seen. I think David's presentation is actually of a more recent draft than 17 August. The last draft that I noticed the date on was 17 August. I think probably when the wiki was updated is more recent than that. And I see I left off on the slide, I left off the wiki pointer. I'm sure Peter will point us to that at some point along the way. That should have been on the slide. I'll rectify that. The state of this thing, as David has identified, is a straw man. It is really an interpretation of the VIM gleaned from a lot of email traffic on the subject. And that's really what it is. There may be some other models involved, but it's really the discussion part that goes on there. And with respect to actually reviewing and commenting on this document, well, that's been the discussion, although it's kind of hard, I'm sure, for David to recognize what part of it is clearly an issue against the document and what part is a philosophical issue around the edge, or the kind of question that seems to arise every time somebody new adds to the group, which is, you used this word and I understand the word to mean this and therefore it's obviously wrong, or therefore, and I think that you should use this word, and the bottom line is that it takes a long time when you do it that way to get onto the same page so we can move on. And I'm not sure how to improve that, but if we're going to get this process ongoing, we've got to do that somehow. The next draft, you will notice, reads, question mark, I don't know. And Dave Leal has been doing the work. And if it weren't for David, there wouldn't be a document out there. Thank you, David. And so that's really the set of things. With respect to the Standards Development Project, as I understand it, it is the judgment of the managing group at this moment, which isn't managing much, but that's okay. Those of us who have been involved in trying to make the project happen, that we don't need to do this too soon. We need to get further along the way, find out what's out there, find out whose work we are going to pattern on, and so on. And there's probably some truth to that, but as a consequence, you can see the four bullets here, all of which are empty. This is to slide 8. We haven't identified a standards body to go to. That may depend on what work we do. Once we've done that, we need to see who is already a member, who is the sponsor in that organization, what we would have to do to get to get a project into that organization. Then you have to go through the actual formal procedure in that organization. And to do all of this, you have to appoint a set of people whose job is to do that. And I can tell you from bitter experience that this takes time, it takes effort, and it's a thankless job, but there won't be a standard that results from this, and I think Gunther can vouch for that, that the process of getting from good intellectual work to a standard is a significant cost. And I think that's the last of my slides. That was intentionally a very brief overview, because the state right now is all we've got is a draft, and we've done a lot of presentation. We know a lot, I think, now about the literature, and we could probably use some more. So I'm done, David. I'll...
Ed?
Yep.
Okay, thank you. My phone's acting up, and actually it stopped me twice, but I disappeared from the call. Hopefully someone else will pick it up so I can call back in. Any questions or comments on what Ed has suggested so far? There's been some discussion going on in the chat, but any questions? Please raise your hand on the chat room. Frank, go ahead, please.
This is Frank. So two things. One is I think that apropos people going around in circles on the email list, one of the things that's helped on the ISO 11179 standard is some sort of issue management system, and they wound up using one of the bug tracker systems to do this, and then people try to address their email, hopefully with reference to particular bugs, and usually the email somehow, I think, gets attached to the bug as part of the bug tracking system. And that helps break up the conversation and keep some of the problems at least of somewhat manageable size. And the other suggestion is having some of this in Word and various other things.
First of all, I failed to mention, by the way, you're right about the idea about bug tracking, or at least formal management of changes, of requests and changes. The trick is to do that, you have to have a stable draft. And by the way, I'm now on my third project that uses Bugzilla, and as far as I'm concerned, that is how to make a mountain out of a molehill. It is the singularly most annoying method of issue tracking I've ever run into, but nonetheless, I'm sure it's thorough. But Joel Bender actually volunteered to do tracking for us, and I see that he's on, or has been on. He may be having trouble being on. But Joel actually volunteered to do some of this for us, and we haven't got to the stage where I think we're ready to make use of what he did. But once we have, a sort of registered draft that we can start talking about as this is the would-be text of the standard, what do we want to change, then I think that's probably a very good idea. And as I said, I had forgotten to mention that that Joel did propose to do this, and we should probably add that to the I should probably add that to the status slide.
Ravi's got his hand up. Ravi Sharma with a question.
Ed, I had a quick quick question for my own clarification. What would this ontology address ultimately is the different types of relationships of units of measures, such as defining all associations and all predicates. Is that the objective? What is the objective of this ontology?
Well, that is the question. I mean, I don't know where we are in that line. I mean, we've been talking about the whole thing with what David Leal has pulled out of the VIM is a base model of quantities which gives rise to an understanding of units of measure. If you then look at something like what's in QUDT or is in the UCUM, you also need a conversion algebra. You need to start talking about how you can express derived units, how you understand what they are, and so on. That's still how. You haven't done anything yet. With respect to actually producing the ontology for the units of measure, one would think that one needs to introduce what are essentially the A boxes. You need to actually introduce meters and kilograms and seconds and so on. And, yeah, then you have to populate the associations that you've discovered. So we actually have two levels of this thing, one of which is essentially the ontological schema, if you like, the class model, and the other is some part of the population that solves the common use problem. I think Günther is quite right when he says that, you know, that's the most, in some sense, that's where the rubber hits the road. That's the thing you have to address, is how are people actually going to use this thing? And to do it, you have to populate that with you know, standard A boxes, and that gets us into the question of how the A boxes are named and so on. But it seems to me we have to do that. Obviously, as everybody has said, there are, you know, millions of entries in some of these boxes, so we're obviously not going to finish that process. But we have to produce the starting point, and some part of that starting point can come out of ISO 1000. After that, I'm not sure. It seems that one would need at least certain English units which are in common use and so on.
Very good. Thank you. I think it means that the first part is more difficult to get started with. Once we have that, then the second part is how to do it.
Yeah, the problem with the second part is when to stop.
Well, that the user community can dictate, saying we got enough starters for how we use this in a practical or example sense, but at least the first part seems to me to be conceptually difficult for everybody to agree on. That's right.
But obviously, we're still doing that.
Okay, we have four more people in the queue for questions, and we're down to about 10 to 15 minutes left in the call. So could Mike Bennett ask the question?
Hi, can you hear me all right? Hello? Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, yes, I can.
Oh, good. Sorry, I was unmuted.
Which means everybody can.
I had successfully done that. Okay, a couple of very quick thoughts. Yes, I think Ravi's point about the scope I think is important because, for example, my interest in tracking this while doing a financial industry model is that there are units for things like currency, and I think it's important that we do have, as we have in the straw man, a good broad concept that goes beyond simply physical units of measurement so that we can semantically define how different kinds of units and measures and so on all fit together in a bigger picture. So I think, A, it's important to determine the scope, and B, I think where we are now with the straw man, where we can put all that together, makes a lot of sense. I have actually struggled, like most people, to keep up with the philosophical exchanges on the email, so I think this session kind of gets us up to speed, and I think it would be good if we can go on to maybe not a formal drug tracking as such, but some kind of structured action on specific things, because, you know, I've got a lot of thoughts about the difference between coordinates and measures of actual things, and I think that fits into the whole thing of how you define certain kinds of thing and so on. And I think getting that conversation pinned down would be very useful for my work and so on.
And just one final thought on the using UML. I think the OMG's standards, I've been using a variant of that. I've adapted it to make the models more readable than the ODM standard actually gives you. And I'd be happy to see if that can be of help to the group or not. So I'm happy to put my 5 minutes in on that kind of thing. So that was really just my quick thoughts on that.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, I fully agree, by the way. I think we're going to need to do some kind of tracking pretty quickly. And so look, we don't have so much time, so I think we should go on, I guess.
Okay. David Leal is next in the queue. David?
Yeah, I was just wanted to sort of respond, you know, in terms of what we're hoping to achieve with this. I think Ed largely covered it, but I think it's setting the framework where people who want to add new units and new quantities, which is important for their domain, can do it without having to invent something. There is a clearly defined environment which has a certain sort of status into which stuff can be added. And that by and large, once you've gone beyond the sort of the content of ISO 1000 and ISO 31, there are lots of different organizations going to be doing it. And you know, it's not ISO's job to add in the US survey foot. Somebody's going to add it in, the whole of the process industry units, which are very special. All the different people are going to be doing it. But if we can set up the structure which enables them to do it and say in a consistent way, yes, this is a unit for length, in a way so that all organizations make that statement in the same way, then we have achieved quite a lot.
Okay, Pat Hayes is next in the queue with a question.
Yeah, it wasn't not a question so much as a comment. I guess I wanted to do a little pushback against the use of UML. I know they look pretty, but UML diagrams can be actually harmful, I think, in that there isn't a clear UML semantics, and therefore the ontological implications of a UML diagram are often quite misleading, or at any rate are unclear. And also, I'm not nearly as optimistic as Ed was about being able to translate UML into OWL. I don't think Elisa's work, unless she's done lots of really startling things in the last year, is going to support a meaningful translation from one to the other.
Oh, Pat, I should say, I've had no intention. Certainly I don't believe that that's what we're going to do. my belief is that and I hope that's David's understanding is that UML is the presentation is a presentation mechanism because everybody has UML tools. But by the same token, we could have used the protege mechanism, but we can actually cram a little bit more onto the UML diagrams if we wanted to. The real question is, I mean, I only see UML as a presentation means. I do not see it as a reference mechanism for the model itself at all.
Okay.
I've been pushing this, is I even wonder whether the OWL ontology would be a reference ontology, but I think the full semantics might require what would require an axiomatic syntax.
Okay.
I was hoping that you might actually agree with that position.
I amazingly I do. I had to search my conscience, but there you go.
Okay, David Leal's next in the queue.
I thought he already spoke.
David Leal, okay, your hand has gone down. Okay. Then Peter?
Yeah, Peter Yim here. I guess we almost have to wrap up, but I did type out a question and about the IPR issues relating to UCOM. I mean, it's just a great chance to have Gunther on the call as well. I mean, there was a little... I guess tension maybe a little while back on the mailing list with the sort of slightly disparate IPR directions that we were going, and as Christopher Shute clearly identified what the HL7 people and most of the healthcare informatics people are doing is following a tradition that most of this stuff are being put out as proprietary stuff. And of course, now going into a team of ISO and international standards folks, and maybe people like myself who is a free and open everything type advocate, we might want to address that. And I have a proposal that I documented here. I mean, I understand the IEEE, I mean, not that they're open, but I mean, when people contribute things to IEEE standard, they make you write up and commit that if it goes into standard, you sort of turn the rights over to IEEE, and if it doesn't make standard, then you keep your rights. Not that we wanted Gunther's rights, but we obviously want Gunther to agree that we could put that into the open and have the final work product have in a open and free license. So maybe that's the beginning of a discussion if Gunther can chip in now, and if it's too long to discuss here, we could take it either on the mailing list or even offline. Reactions, Gunther?
No one else has their hand up in the queue. Any other questions or comments about Ed's presentation or anything else we've been discussing? Peter, were you asking a question of Dr. Shadow?
Yes, I was. And I was even hoping that he would just say yes. But I guess maybe he's already dropped off.
It appears he's gone from the chat list
right.
Anyway.
Then we might as well just move on to you, Frank, and yourself to wrap up the session.
Frank, do you have comments? Would you like to start wrapping up?
There is one thing. We were talking about having a face-to-face meeting on October 30th, which is a Friday after the Semantic Web Conference, and I have reserved the Director's Conference Room, room 1235 at NSF. We'll have to make arrangements for people to register ahead of time so they can get badges, and we run the risk that we are preempted by the Director of NSF if he needs the room for something. But at the moment, we have a room. It will hold something like 25 or 30 people around the table, and there are auxiliary chairs for another 20 people or something in the back of the room, or maybe 30, another 25 people if we have to. So we can accommodate, and the room has internet connections and power and audiovisual stuff and other things like that. We should be okay.
How about getting into the building?
We have to put together a list of everyone who wants to come and get badges prepared for them. And you probably have to bring photo ID. But there's no issue about problems getting foreign nationals into the property. We do that all the time. But we do need to prepare the badges ahead of time. That's the only, like most federal institutions, everybody has to be badged at all times. But it hasn't been a problem getting people onto the site. I do it all the time for panels.
Okay, thanks.
Need a couple of days' notice.
Yeah,
72 hours' notice or something like that.
Frank,
we can probably do a few people last minute.
Frank, just to make sure I document it correctly onto the chat board, it's room 225 NSF, right?
No, room 1235.
1235. Good.
director's conference room on the 12th floor of National Science Foundation. And I'll get you the name of some. I'll arrange for somebody in our division to handle getting badges and stuff. I'll put up when we start preparing the web page for that meeting. I'll get the email address for somebody who can handle creating badges. That's the only thing I wanted to add. We just got that today, and we have about a 75% chance of hanging on to that room.
Great.
And I think it's a suitable room for this thing. I shudder to think of putting more than about 25 or 30 people trying to thrash out the standard. I'm done.
David's there? Final words? David, you may still be on mute. Can't hear you. Right? If David does not have another statement or announcement to make, let's say, and let's thank everyone for another great session, and we'll look forward to continuing discussion on the mailing list and at the workshop on the 30th, which will mainly be a face-to-face for those who are actually doing the work, and then we would be welcoming everyone else interested as observers. So it's a real workshop with observers. On that note, thanks everyone again. Yep. Is that Frank or David?
No, it's David Price. Sorry, Mike. Okay. I got disconnected from the call, so I just called back in.
All right. Just in time to wrap us up.
I realize we're a little over time, but it just occurs to me that between now and the workshop or the face-to-face, to have a straw man that's for review, we need to answer some of the questions that are in and the question marks that are in Ed Barkmeyer's presentation about people willing to do some work between now and then. Is there a way to cover that as a email chat, I suppose, or did that get discussed while I was offline?
It didn't get discussed, David, and we are out of time, but I think we're going to need to have some sort of management call independent, but we can certainly go ahead with the with trying to do this on the email and see if we can get more foolish volunteers.
Looks like that's it. Thank you, everyone. And we will be posting the recording of this session. All the slides are already online, and the chat transcript and the audio recording will be posted shortly. Bye.
Thank you, Peter.